And for public broadcasting.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. In a moment, we're going to meet one of the state's leading scientists on red tide, one of the leading experts in Florida about red tide. We're going to talk about him in a moment. He's not well loved among the agriculture and the sugar community, and even some agencies that work on wildlife protection don't like him. So we're going to meet him in just a few minutes. But first, some candidate announcements. As a public service, WMNF is offering free airtime for political candidates. We're giving up to 2 minutes of free airtime for a message recorded by the candidates themselves. The message may include anything the political candidate would like to say about why they should be elected to office. The candidate may also include contact information, and this offer is open to any candidate, regardless of party, who's running statewide or locally and who is on the ballot on August 28th in Hillsborough, Pinellas, Sarasota, Pasco, Polk, and Manatee counties. Candidates may record their messages right now at 813-238-8001, extension 115. We'll be playing the messages back during the 11 a.m. hour during the next 2 weeks. Any message over the two-minute time limit will be edited to reduce the length. Again, the place to record a candidate's message is 813-238-8001, extension 115. All messages must be recorded by 9 a.m. on August 21st, and we encourage candidates to record their messages quickly. We have a limited amount of time in which to air the messages. Well, we're going to hear the first two candidate messages right now that have been called in. Both are candidates for the school board in Pinellas County. And here is the first message for a political candidate here in the WMNF listening area. Again, we're going to hear from a candidate for Pinellas School Board.
Internationally, globally, and locally, education is the new currency. It's what our students need in order to be able to compete. My name is Renee Flowers, and I'm currently serving as the chair of the Pinellas County School Board, and I'm asking for your vote on or before August 28th. We've been able to accomplish a number of things throughout the county. We've increased our graduation rate. We've been able to retain teachers and increase teacher pay. We've addressed student discipline factors, and we provided some additional wraparound services to include mental health services. While it is true that we have things that we need to enhance and increase, I am confident that with your help and with your vote, we will be able to reach the finish line. You know, there's an adage that says the mind is a terrible thing to waste. And I am confident, no, I'm assured, that the students in Pinellas County are moving forward, reaching beyond leaps and bounds. So remember, on or before the 28th of August, you will have an opportunity to vote for me. I'm proud to announce that I've been recommended by the Tampa Bay Times. I've been endorsed by Mayor Rick Kreisman and Mayor Sam Henderson. I've been endorsed by Senator Daryl Roussan, Commissioner Ken Welch, Lisa Willa Bowman, as well as Congressman Chris. I've also been endorsed by the National Organization for Women, SEIU, Ruthless, and so many others. But the most important endorsement is yours. On or before August 28th, you have the ability to return me to the Pinellas County School Board to finish what, in fact, we have started. Remember, all of our students are an incredible resource, and we must do everything we can to make sure that they are successful. Vote Renee Flowers on or before August 28th, returning me to Pinellas County School Board to finish what we began.
All right, so that was our first candidate taking us up on our offer of free airtime to all political candidates who are on the ballot on August 28th. That was Renee Flowers, who's running for school board in Pinellas County. Let's listen to our second candidate.
Good morning. I'm Peggy O'Shea, candidate for re-election to the Pinellas County School Board in District 3. District 3 is a countywide race. All registered voters in Pinellas County can vote in the primary on August 28th. I promise to keep our children safe. Protecting our children is our top priority, and we will always go above and beyond what's required of us to make sure that we have a safe and secure learning environment for our kids. My record supports my efforts to protect your taxpayer dollars and properly manage our funds and find savings and efficiencies each and every year as we proceed to provide the most for our children. I will continue to provide opportunities and choices for all students and parents. I'm asking for your vote for Peggy O'Shea, Pinellas County School Board, District 3, on August 28th. For information or questions, please call me at 727-858-1284. Thank you.
Well, that was the second candidate who took us up on our offer of free airtime for candidates. We're going to be doing this for the next few days until next Wednesday. And so it is offered on a first-come, first-served basis. And we'll be doing more of these candidate announcements tomorrow. Well, in just a moment, we're going to have an interview with one of the top Florida scientists on the question of what causes red tide and why is this year's outbreak so, so horrible. You're listening to 88.5 FM. This is WMNF in Tampa. There's some music from Oliver Mitikudzi. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. The Sarasota Herald Tribune is reporting that the city of Sarasota has declared a state of emergency. They did this yesterday amid the toxic red tide outbreak that has killed area marine life, stifled tourism, and sickened people. Sarasota declared the state of emergency to secure possible financial assistance from the state and federal government as red tide tightened its grip in recent weeks on the area, killing an undetermined amount of sea life and sickened people along Florida's southwest coast. Red tide first crept up to Manatee County beaches more than 10 days ago, and it has stuck around since with almost no reprieve. On Monday, Governor Rick Scott declared a state of emergency for Manatee, Sarasota, Charlotte, Collier, Hillsborough, Lee, and Pinellas counties. Scott pledged to use all state resources to assist the seven southwest Florida counties dealing with the noxious bloom. And here to talk about red tide is Larry Brandt. He's at the Marine Biology and Ecology Department of Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science at the University of Miami. And he's one of Florida's leading experts on red tide. And Larry Brandt, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
So, Larry, tell me how long you've been studying red tide.
For about 15 years.
Now, it is true that going back to the 1500s, red tide has been noted as an occurrence in the Gulf waters, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. This year, it seems worse than normal. Perhaps it's the worst, I think, since the outbreak in 2005. Is that correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
All right. So tell us, you know, what is red tide?
The red tide is sort of a nickname for a specific type of what we call a harmful algal bloom. And the one we're dealing with now, the one we typically get off the west coast of Florida, is caused by a type of algae, a microscopic algae. The specific name is Karenia brevis. And it produces a neurotoxin called brevetoxin. And that's what people are experiencing right now.
Now, when did this outbreak begin, the current one?
It began last October. It wasn't as bad as now, but it began last October, and it's been sort of puttering along and moving up and down the coast for like the last 9 months or so.
Now, is this unusual to have a nine-month outbreak?
We've had outbreaks like this before, but yeah, they don't happen very often. It's been many years. I mean, the last time we had a really big outbreak like this was, in fact, the 2004 or 2006 period.
You've been studying this for 30 years. In those 30 years, is the length of red tide outbreaks getting longer?
I can't really say for the 30-year period, but I did do a study looking at all records over like a 50-year period. And what in comparing early, you know, a decade and back, you know, 50 years ago versus a recent decade, what I found is that if you look at just the total abundance, the intensity of these blooms, I found that it's like 15 times worse today than it was 50 years ago. Okay, and also from a seasonal point of view, these blooms do tend to extend through longer periods of the year. The blooms used to be primarily for short periods of time in the summer and fall months, and now we're seeing it more often extending on into the winter and spring.
Now, what feeds this algae known as Carinia brevis?
Could you repeat that?
What feeds it? What does it live on?
Okay, well, these are algae, so they need nutrients, just the same nutrients you'd feed to your garden, you know, primarily nitrogen and phosphorus.
All right, so at the same time, we've got this problem from Lake Okeechobee. The lake is filling up with water, and a lot of that water contains nutrients. Some of it has to be let out through the Caloosahatchee River. Is there any connection between the water that's being let out of Lake Okeechobee and this long red tide bloom?
Almost certainly. You have the watershed of Lake Okeechobee includes a huge amount of agricultural land. And you get a lot of fertilizer runoff from that agricultural land. That's been going on for many decades. And so that's why we have algal blooms in Lake Okeechobee. I mean, that used to be fairly clear water, nice, clean, sandy bottom, and so on. And then many decades ago, because all this agricultural fertilizer, you start getting all these algal blooms. It's a different type of algae called cyanobacteria, also known as blue-green algae. And pretty much just like in 2004, 2005, 2006, back then, 2004, 2005, 2004, we had four hurricanes hit Florida, three of which went through the watershed of Lake Okeechobee. And then 2005, we had two more hurricanes. So you have a lot of rainfall. You're flushing a lot of this nutrient-rich water down into the lake. That lake gets high. It's surrounded by a 30-foot dike, earthen dike. And so, you know, it's in danger of bursting. And so Army Corps of Engineers has no choice but to release that water. And the two major outlets are the to the west down the Caloosahatchee River and to the east down the St. Lucie Canal. So, and what we've seen the exact same thing this year after Hurricane Irma last fall. And so you have these blooms of cyanobacteria coming out of the lake down the Caloosahatchee River, and it's the same species of these cyanobacteria, and you have this really nutrient-rich water along with the blooms of cyanobacteria released down the river into the estuary, and now it's actually making it out into the Gulf. And, of course, these cyanobacteria are freshwater algae, so they die in the seawater eventually. And when they die, they release even more nutrients, and almost certainly those nutrients are feeding this red tide, making it even worse.
All right, so you think that if we did something about the nutrient load that was coming out of Lake Okeechobee, if we lessened that, we might lessen red tide?
Yes.
You've been suggesting this for years.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Isn't the first year you've said there's a connection.
Yes, I mean, about 20 years ago, I pointed out there's a connection with the blooms of cyanobacteria down in Florida Bay. I've got 15 years' worth of data showing that every time you pump this nutrient-rich water out of the sugarcane fields to the south of Lake Okeechobee, you get larger blooms of these cyanobacteria down there. So if you send the water south, you get blooms of cyanobacteria. If you send the water to the west, you get blooms of cyanobacteria along the west coast, along the Caloosahatchee River. And I would argue you're making the red tide worse along the west coast. And if you send the water east down the St. Lucie Canal into the St. Lucie Estuary and southern Indian River Lagoon, you get blooms of cyanobacteria there. And you might remember in summer 2016, 2 years ago, we had those famous guacamole blooms.
Yeah, and it's pretty bad in some places this year, too. We got some of that guacamole this year. We're talking with Larry Brand, who's a marine biologist at the University of Miami, and this is WMNF in Tampa. We're talking about the red tide outbreak and the possible connection between the pollution load in Lake Okeechobee and that red tide outbreak. And this is 88.5 FM. If you want to email a question into the studio, you can. Our address is dj@wmnf.org. Larry Brand, have you made the case to the Department of Environmental Protection or the local water boards to say these nutrients that we're putting on our land are hurting the oceans on both of Florida's coasts?
Well, with respect to red tide, I know in the past when I pointed this out and I published papers on this, they argued I was wrong, and they continued. My knowledge, they continue to argue that there's no connection between land runoff of human-based nutrients and the red tide. They argue it's completely natural. My view is, yes, I mean, the red tide is natural. As you mentioned, it's been around for at least 500 years. But again, I saw a 15-fold increase over the past 50 years. I can't think of any natural nutrient sources that have increased 15-fold. Now, what has increased dramatically here in South Florida over the last 50 years? Well, basically, it's us. I mean, huge increase in human population and associated fertilizer runoff and so on.
Does fertilizer runoff or agricultural runoff, does it have a footprint? Does it have a way to identify itself so that if you're out in the Gulf of Mexico and you find increased nitrogen levels, that nitrogen could be tied to some sort of either man-made cause or cow pastures, or the sugar industry?
Not easily. I mean, there are some people who use isotopes, but it's fairly complicated, and there's almost always considerable disagreement among scientists how you interpret those isotopic signatures.
Yeah, so there's no easy footprint.
There's no footprint that everyone can agree upon and say, yes, it's, 80% this and 20% that or anything like that. It'd be nice to have that, but I've been able to figure out that.
Is the state of Florida being cooperative in that? Does it monitor the levels of nutrients being let out of Lake Okeechobee? Does it do a good job of monitoring how much nitrogen load there is coming out of Lake Okeechobee? It does a good job.
South Florida Water Management District, partly because of the Everglades Restoration Plan, they've got a large network throughout all of South Florida, throughout all the canals, et cetera. And they do measure the nutrient concentrations in those waters, yes. And I've used their data set for my own analysis as to what's going on here.
Are you confident enough in your research that you would say to the state of Florida, look, we've got to stop the nitrogen load in Lake Okeechobee because that is contributing to red tide? Are you pretty confident?
I've made that statement many times.
Many times.
And numerous public talks and so on, yes.
And you haven't found an audience yet or not a very receptive audience, I take it?
Well, I find very receptive audiences among the citizens throughout Florida. I mean, in fact, I gave a presentation or was involved in a presentation just Tuesday night over in Fort Myers and one or maybe a month ago over in Stewart, and I've been given these types of presentations explaining my data for many years, actually, in various places within South Florida. And, basically, a lot of the residents, when I show them the data, they understand what's going on. They can see the connection between human-based nutrients and the harmful algal blooms that we're seeing in both freshwater and seawater.
Did you have a big crowd in down in Fort Myers?
It was a capacity crowd. They had, I think, 455 people, and they turned away. I was told they had to turn away at least a couple hundred people.
All right, so in terms of policy, what should Florida do? If I could, let me just outline a few things. One is pollution into the Kissimmee River watershed. Two is leaking septic tanks. Three is agriculture pollution surrounding Lake Okeechobee, excluding sugar. And four being sugar. If Florida were to work on one of those problems of loading nutrients into Lake Okeechobee, which one do you think would help reduce red tide most?
Boy, that's a difficult one, because, again, it gets back to the question of trying, you know, any given location, you've got different mixtures of those different sources, and trying to estimate the relative mix is rather difficult. So if you're talking about nutrients going into Lake Okeechobee,
yeah,
clearly the answer would be all the nutrients in the agricultural lands north of Lake Okeechobee. That's the major contributor right now. However, I need to point out, while the sugarcane fields to the south of Lake Okeechobee are no longer allowed to back pump that nutrient-rich water from their fields back up into Lake Okeechobee, except under rare circumstances, they did do so for many decades, and that's part of the major reason why you have so much nutrients in the lake. And so the problem you've got is you've got a huge amount of nutrients already stored up in the sediments of that lake. And so it's a shallow lake. It's easy to stir up those sediments, releasing the nutrients from the sediments back up into the water column. So what you're seeing is a mixture of the current nutrients coming down from the north along with the what we call legacy nutrients in those sediments. And it's a mixture of those two that are going down the Quisette River. So in terms of policy, you can't do much on the short term about the legacy nutrients, but you can certainly try to reduce the nutrients coming from the north down the Kissimmee River.
All right, and the north, there's not much sugar to the north. It's mainly cattle, citrus, other agriculture like tomatoes and vegetables, and the Kissimmee River development north of Lake Okeechobee, the Kissimmee River watershed.
Correct.
Yeah. All right. What would your recommendation be? What if you were in charge of the state environment and you wanted to reduce both the toxic algae that's coming out of Lake Okeechobee and the red tide, what would you recommend?
Okay, first of all, I'm a scientist. I'm not a lawyer or anything like that. So I don't know all the details of the laws. All I would simply say is it's pretty clear the current laws that we have about nutrient pollution are not working and/or they're not being enforced. I guess from my point of view, from a simplistic point of view, I don't have a dog, but if I did have a dog and I picked up the dog feces with a shovel and tossed it over my fence into, say, my neighbor's pool, I'd probably get sued or something, right?
Yeah.
But essentially, we let agriculture do that. You know, they basically are allowed to dump all their fertilizer runoff into our public waterways. That's the problem. And then the people downstream are the ones who are suffering the consequences of the toxins that result from these algal blooms.
And Larry, one more question about another possible cause, climate change. Are the Gulf waters, the Gulf of Mexico waters, warmer, historically speaking, and does that cause a rise to a longer outbreak of red tide or more severe outbreak of red tide?
So the Gulf is getting warmer as a result of global warming. It's a pretty minor player. I mean, I won't go into the details. You could argue that it enhances the red tide a little bit, or it gives the red tide a better of an advantage over other types of algae in the water, because they are in competition with other types of algae. But, you know, having warmer water doesn't give you 15 times more nutrients. So the major cause of increased harmful algal blooms is the increased nutrients coming from human activities.
Okay, so let me read Larry, I don't know how much time you've got, but do you have a few more minutes?
Sure.
All right, Larry Brand is a marine biologist at the University of Miami. He's live with us today on WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. David sends in this email. He says, I think Bill Nelson should push harder against Governor Rick Scott and run some incriminating attack ads against Scott. Nelson could point out how Scott gutted the state's water management boards and encouraged out-of-control development by eliminating the Department of Community Affairs. And Nelson could also point out how Scott pulled back on new regulations on septic tank inspections. The ads could start with ominous music and Scott's face next to a pile of feces with a deep-voiced narrator. It's all about the poo-poo, Mr. Mr. Scott. David raises the question of septic tanks. I mentioned earlier, how much do septic tanks contribute, do you think, to the nutrient load in our freshwater systems here in Florida? Do you have any idea about that?
Well, yeah, you know, it gets back to this question of, you know, the relative importance, and determining that is fairly difficult. I'll just give you one example, though. If you look at the Indian River Lagoon, you get blooms in the southern end, you get blooms in the northern end. So you think back to those blooms in 2016, we had the famous guacamole blooms there. They happen precisely when there's a huge release of this nutrient-rich water from Lake Okeechobee down the St. Lucie Canal and to the southern Indian River Lagoon. Almost certainly, that was caused primarily by the nutrients coming down. Like, I mean, it's the same species of algae, too. So, I mean, almost certainly that was primarily the result of the agricultural nutrients coming down from Lake Okeechobee. Okay, about the same time, you also had, you know, you had other blooms, other species up in the northern Indian River Lagoon. Almost certainly that was not from Lake Okeechobee coming down the St. Lucie estuary. And so it's quite plausible anyway, that septic tanks were maybe the major source of the nutrients up in the Indian River Lagoon. You certainly can't blame it on Lake Okeechobee. So it really depends on where you go.
Okay. All right. Do you think that we should have greater regulation on septic tanks?
In certain areas, probably. I mean, you have to assess the possibility of those septic tanks. You know, particularly people who are living really close to the water bodies. I mean, a classic example was down in the Florida Keys. Most people are on septic tanks, and they live on those little finger canals right next. The homes are right next to the water, so they can have their boats there next to their homes. They're sitting on this porous limestone. It's clear that the nutrients coming out of septic tanks going into the waterways and our local waters are leading out to the coral reefs. And so a huge effort went into converting the septic tank systems down there to a sewage treatment system.
And that's been successful?
As, from what I can tell, yes. Yeah. I've been told by people living down there that, yes, they definitely saw improvements in the water quality.
We got a lot of emails. So, Larry, I know you've got a meeting coming up, so anytime you got to go, let us know. But Sid writes this, in addition to the releases from Lake Okeechobee, what are the possible effects of nutrient-rich waters from the Peace River, which flows into the Gulf via Charlotte Harbor and Boca Grande Pass? The Peace River, do you think that upstream, the development, the phosphate upstream in the Peace River watershed contributes?
Well, that was actually one of the first hypotheses I looked into when I started dealing with the Florida Bay issue 20 years ago. And what I found, yes, I mean, you have the Peace River drains that phosphate mining area up there. So it is very rich in phosphorus. But what I found when looking at the data is over time it actually had been decreasing in terms of phosphate concentrations. At the same time, we were seeing increasing blooms down in Florida Bay. And that turned out to be the result of environmental regulations. You know, because of the massive releases in the past and the huge environmental degradation, there have been increased environmental regulation. And so they forced the phosphate mines to clean up their act, so they reduced less phosphorus. Now, I can't say that the phosphorus levels are back to background levels, but they would naturally be phosphorus rich in the first place, because that whole area up there, that watershed, is again naturally phosphorus enriched. And for that reason, the whole West Florida shelf typically is relatively rich in phosphorus. So the real problem there is the nitrogen. And, you know, it's when you release more nitrogen into the West Florida shelf, the West Coast there, that you get the algal blooms. And turns out the sugarcanes are particularly rich in nitrogen. So for many decades, they dumped huge amounts of nitrogen into Lake Okeechobee, and you now still have large amounts of nitrogen in that lake coming down the Clissiatch River, feeding out to the West Coast where you get the red tide.
So is it safe to say that there's really two major forms of nutrients that we should avoid or try to avoid? One is phosphorus, but a lot of that is coming from the phosphate mines, and nitrogen, a lot of that is coming from agriculture, sugar, cattle, and lawn fertilizer.
Yes. Well, the phosphorus, turns out the animal farms dairy farms and cattle and so on, that tends to be a little bit more phosphorus rich. It's the sugarcane fields in the northern part of the Everglades that turn out to be extremely nitrogen rich. And most agriculture is sort of evenly balanced, rich in both nitrogen and phosphorus. But it turns out the sugarcane fields are particularly rich in nitrogen.
So
you mix that in with the high phosphorus on the West Coast, it gives you particularly large blooms.
All right. Larry, I don't want to hold you on too long, but can we take a phone call from a listener?
Sure.
All right, let's take a call. And my phone system's down here, so I'm going to have to guess at this caller. Caller, you're on WMNF. What's your name and where are you calling from? And you're on with Larry Brand, a marine biologist at the University of Miami.
This is Chris Steiner here in Tampa. And Larry, thank you for your work. I'd like it if you could give your contact information. And on the Facebook page for WMNF News and this article I'll mention, I posted the link to from Green Med Info that is entitled Ties Between Red Tide Expert Moat, which is Moat Marine Labs, and Florida Polluter Mosaic Raises Red Flags. And it states that Mosaic is listed as a benefactor. It links to Moat Marine's Lab's own website where Mosaic Phosphate Mining Company is a benefactor of Moat. And, you know, yet Moat is being used by the Florida Fish and Wildlife Service and U.S. Sugar to try to hold the phosphorus discharge or phosphorus as a contribution to the red tide. They say that both the Florida Fish and Wildlife Service and Moat Marine Labs have the exact same quote where it says, in contrast to the many red tide species that are fueled by nutrient pollution associated with urban or agricultural runoff, there is no direct link between nutrient pollution and the frequency or severity of red tides caused by K. brevis. Florida red tides develop 10 to 40 miles offshore away from man-made nutrient sources. Red tides occurred in Florida long before human settlement, and severe red tides were observed in the mid-1900s before the state's coastlines were heavily developed. However, once red tides are transported inshore, they are capable of using man-made nutrients.
Chris, I don't want you to read the whole article, but the bottom line is that you suspect that Moat Marine, because it gets money from Mosaic Phosphate, has a conflict of interest. So
it gets donation. It gets non-monetary contributions. Mosaic does fund their Moat's programs, which are listed in the article I linked to on WMNF News website. I just emailed you, Rob. And also, if you look at
I don't mean to cut you off. It's an important topic, but because Larry's only here for a few minutes, and I don't know if you're comfortable getting into the politics of Moat Marine. If you don't want to, I understand. And Chris, that really, we need to kind of separate that from Larry's work as a research scientist, if you don't mind. Okay.
I'm just Chris? Reinforcing what he's saying, and also that according to the Charlotte County's own website, the phosphate in the last three winters has contributed. There's a correlation of most apparently to the red tide the last three winters in the Peace River watershed in Charlotte Harbor.
All right, let's go to that point. Chris, thanks a lot. Thanks for your question. Larry, in the last 3 years, has the Peace River watershed and the phosphate in that watershed, has that contributed to red tide?
I don't know. I haven't looked at those data in the last few years. Again, like I said before, that the West Florida shelf, that area, is already naturally phosphorus enriched. So generally, nitrogen is the major problem. Now, having said that, I have to go back and look at the data to see if this additional phosphorus coming down the phosphorus down the Peace River may be contributing yet more. That's certainly a possibility, but I really can't say at the present time. I haven't seen those data.
All right.
I'm certainly aware of Moat Marine's position. I mean, they argued against me many years ago.
And do you want to comment about Moat Marine at all?
Well, I mean, I'm aware of their connections with industry and with the state government and so on, and we have very different views on how to interpret the data.
All right. Let's take maybe one or two more phone calls. Larry Brand is our guest. He's a marine biologist at the University of Miami, and this is 88.5 FM. We're talking about red tide and the possible causes of that massive outbreak. Caller, you're on WMNF. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Kathy from Clearwater.
Hi, Kathy. What's your question?
I have two questions. I know a lot of counties in Florida have gone and restricted applications of nitrogen during certain times of the year, and I want to know if that's helping or if it's not being enforced enough or what. And then also, like the sugar industry, don't they have like settling ponds or I don't know what they call them, like a succession of ponds where they clean out the stuff? They don't have to have that stuff? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right, Kathy. Thanks a lot.
Okay, yes. So after that huge red tide we had 2004 through 2006, that stimulated a lot of the counties to develop fertilizer ordinances, which basically said if you're near the water, you're not. Well, I guess two things. First of all, there's controls on what you can do in terms of fertilizing if you're near the water, and also restricting fertilizer sales during the summer and fall when you have your most rainfall and for runoff. That certainly helps. How much is not clear because, again, you know, it's the relative importance of people's lawn fertilizer versus this huge area of agriculture and the watershed. My own inclination, I don't have numbers really, but my inclination is the agricultural fertilizer is much larger. On the other hand, you know, people tend to over-fertilize their lawns. They figure a little bit's good, more is better.
And Larry,
I would certainly encourage people to use less fertilizer.
Well, Larry, but you know, in the summer months, even up here, even though there's a ban on application of fertilizer in the summer, I still see people both watering their lawns in rainstorms, and I see people applying fertilizer in the summer months. Does that ever happen to you down in South Florida? And what do you do if you see that?
I don't see it. I certainly don't do that myself. I don't fertilize it. I don't fertilize at all, except a little bit on my vegetable garden. It makes no sense for me to be watering during a rainstorm. I do see that. I do see people watering during.
Do you want to just knock on those folks' doors and say, what are you thinking?
Well, no, I don't. Don't get involved in those kinds
of
things.
Yeah, okay. All right. You're a very, very peaceful guy. Larry Brand is our guest. He's a marine biologist at the University of Miami. Let's take one more phone call before he goes. Caller, you're on the air. What's your name and where are you calling from? Hi, caller, you're on the air. What's your name and where are you calling from?
This is Wendy from Tampa.
Hi, Wendy. Thanks for calling in. What would you like to ask Larry?
Good topic this morning on both of you. Thanks for your efforts. Also a question regarding Lake Okeechobee. I know in the past that Lake Panasoffski, they cleaned and dredged and took all the old muck off of the bottom and everything and made the Lake Panasoffski water quality and everything a lot better. Would that be something possible to do with Lake Okeechobee? To segment it and do that to clean the old sediment off, if that would help? And my other question is, with the problems in Lake Okeechobee, I know my great-great-uncle used to use barley bales to clean his ponds on his acreage when they'd get really algaed up. He would tie them off with a chicken wire around them and that and dredge them through and to capture all the algae off the top of the pond and that and clear them. And I'm just wondering if that's still a viable old-fashioned way of clearing the algae and the canals and everything down there without using any other unnecessary oversized equipment and stuff.
I'll take the second part of that question first. I'm aware of the barley technique, and apparently it is used successfully in small ponds, things like that. But the large scale here, I mean, I might have my numbers wrong here, but Lake Okeechobee is like 700 and something square miles, either square miles or square kilometers. I can't remember exactly now. It's huge. It's the second, I mean, it's the largest freshwater lake in the United States after the Great Lakes. And just the logistics of this and the expense of that is sort of mind-boggling. And people did look into this. You know, there's been discussions of people, you know, dredging out all that muck, this nutrient-rich sediment that has accumulated in the bottom of Lake Okeechobee is many feet thick now.
Right.
But again, I think just the logistics of this over such a huge area and the expense of it is just not feasible. I mean, again, my view is once you've dumped these nutrients into your watershed, there's not a whole lot you can do about it. You really need to stop the source of the nutrients at their source. Once you've let those nutrients into your watershed, into the waters, anything you try to do to get rid of the nutrients or the algae is going to be extremely expensive and logistically impossible.
All right, Wendy, there you go. There you go.
Thank you.
Thanks, Wendy.
Have a great day.
All right, thanks. Larry, can people look up your research? Is there a way that people can look up your research and find out, your statement that there is a connection between red tide and the nitrogen and phosphate loads in our fresh water that we pump out to the Gulf and to the ocean? Is there a way that people can look at your research?
I'm not sure if my papers are... I mean, they're in the scientific literature. They can look it up that way. But a lot of people don't have access to those journals and so on. So the best would be for people to email me, and then I can send them PDFs of those scientific papers.
And how can they email you, if you don't mind?
Well, I guess I can get my email over the phone here. They can also just look at the University of Miami Marine School. They can find my name and contact information there. But my email is lbrand@rsmas.miami.edu.
All right. And Larry, just a quick last question. Does any of this nitrogen load come from the atmosphere? Does it come from...
A small amount does, but I mean, it's tiny compared to these other sources.
Well, Larry Brand, it's good to have you back on WMNF. And would you expect that this red tide problem is going to just keep getting worse as it seems that summer rains keep getting heavier and we don't seem to be doing much about agriculture around Lake Okeechobee? Would you expect red tide to get worse?
So, yeah, I mean, we're in the rainy season right now. It'll be going on for a few more months. So, yeah, we're going to continue to be dumping more nutrients into these waterways, so I expect it'll probably continue for several more months. Unless, you could have a hurricane or something like that to disperse the red tide, or winds blowing from the east could disperse it or push it offshore, but basically these ditches would be continuing to be dumped into the waterways for the next few months. Now, hopefully, as we move into the dry season with less rain runoff, maybe these will finally dissipate, but you can be sure this is going to continue in the future. I mean, next rainy season, we'll have these same problems. I mean, it's going to continue.
All right. Well, Larry Brand, thanks a lot. Thanks for coming on WMNF.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Great to have you here. That's Larry Brand. He's a marine biologist at the University of Miami. He's with the Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science there at the University of Miami. And he is one of the state's leading experts on red tide. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. I'm Rob Lori, and thanks for tuning in. And here's a message. This guy is not very happy with me. He says, you're suggesting to knock on doors to tell people to turn off their sprinklers. Is that kind of like yelling at somebody to get out of a handicapped parking space if they don't have a sticker? And this person who's anonymous writes, effing hypocrite, and effing isn't the exact word he used. You know, let me just tell you that I do a lot of bike riding, and I do a lot of walking around the Tampa Bay area. And I do see people in the middle of rainstorms watering their lawns. And I do see people in the summertime putting fertilizer on their lawns. And I would never, ever, ever suggest that an individual go up and challenge somebody who's got a sprinkler on or fertilizer on. But I do wonder if somebody lives here and if you appreciate Florida's beautiful environment, does it rankle you when you see somebody putting a lot of fertilizer on their lawns in the summer? Does it rankle you to see fresh water wasted on somebody's lawn during a rainstorm? And if knocking on their door is the wrong thing to do, and I agree with the caller, I'm not suggesting it. I'm just, you know, this is a thought that does go through my head, I've got to admit. But what do you do if you really love Florida's environment and you don't want to see it screwed up? What do you do? I mean, and if everybody does it, if everybody waters their lawn during a rainstorm, and if everybody fertilizes their lawn during the summer season, then what do we have? Do we have the Florida that we came here for? Do we have the Florida that we grew up with? Does it matter to you? I mean, I don't think it matters to this guy that called me an effing hypocrite, but I think it matters to most people. 813-239-9663, email address dj@wmnf.org. I don't think our phone playlist system here is working, but we're going to put people on the air, and we'll try to figure out a way to do it. Let's caller, you're on WMNF. What's your name and where are you calling from? Hi, caller, what's your name and where are you calling from?
Michael Wallace. Calling from Sarasota.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for calling. No need to give your last name, but first name is great. Thanks for calling in. What do you think?
Well, I was hoping to ask a question of your guest, which is I have a friend who grew up in Wisconsin, and they had They had a huge lake up there that had a terrible algal bloom, and they used copper sulfate. And I remember my father using copper sulfate in a swimming pool that we had that was concrete sides and a stream running through it that ran right into Croton Reservoir in New York. And the reservoir authority was okay with it, so apparently it's not toxic to people or wildlife. And I just wondered why that might not help in Lake Okeechobee.
Yeah, well, as Larry was saying, Lake Okeechobee is either 700 square kilometers. It's big. I think it's the second largest freshwater lake inside the U.S. So it's giant. And having all that copper sulfate, and we're talking, as Larry pointed out, we're talking about probably 75 years worth of pollution on the sediment bottom there in Lake Okeechobee. And,
well, but this would be for the algal bloom. It wouldn't do anything for the sediment.
Yeah.
It wouldn't stop the sediment and the nutrients running into the Gulf, but it might be able to get rid of the algae bloom.
And Larry's not here, and I don't know. Larry's not really an expert on mitigating problems. He's more of an expert on finding what the cause of the problem is. But I don't know. Maybe we can find an expert on that topic. All right, Michael, thanks a lot. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you.
And suggesting copper sulfate. Let's take another phone call. Caller, you're on WMNF. What's your name and where are you calling from? Hi, caller. You're on WMNF. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Yes.
Hi. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hi. My name is Helen. I'm calling from Ruskin, Florida. How are you today?
Thanks, Helen. Thanks. What would you like to say?
Well, we live along the Little Manatee River, and we notice like we have a neighbor that has just a beautiful yard. We see him fertilizing all the time and taking care of the yard. My question is, who do we contact in reference to? We also notice that they dump their leaves and clippings and stuff into like a small creek that feeds right into the river. So we see the water going all summer long and everything is just gorgeous and green and blooming, but this dumping, I'm sure, is what's causing a lot of chaos in the water system.
Well, Hillsborough County has a really strong Environmental Protection Commission, and you might call them up to just say, hey, look, I'm wondering about the nutrient load in the creek and the river based
right.
on what our neighbors are doing and see if they can recommend anything. Maybe they would come out and inspect. I don't know.
Right, yeah. I was wondering if there was like a place I could get some flyers to just kind of put out to the neighbors, you know, to say, hey,
yeah, because a lot of times people put things in the river and don't realize that if you're adding things that are heavy in nitrogen and phosphorus, that is actual pollution in the river that causes algae downstream. Some people move here and don't
Correct.
Know that. Yeah.
Right, right. Well, I
kind of looks like they almost like sneak it when they do it. So I think they know it's not supposed to be done, you know. And my husband has seen it happen. And he's like, I didn't want to approach them, but, you know, we've been talking about it. And, you know, so the Hillsborough Environmental Association, you said?
Hillsborough Environmental Protection Commission.
Okay, very good. I appreciate the information.
All right, Helen, thanks a lot.
All right, and you have a great day.
Okay, you too. You know, it could be that perhaps the Hillsborough County Commission ought to take out ads on some of the commercial TV stations and mention to people, you know, when you put phosphorus or nitrogen or other fertilizers on your lawn or on your agriculture or that it runs off into the river, and we can all help the environment by using less fertilizer. 813-239-9663 is our phone number, email address, dj@wmnf.org. Bill Grace is answering the phones, but our the screen that tells me who's calling in is not working here in the air studio. Sorry about that. Caller, you're on MNF. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hi, this is activist Mark from St. Pete.
Hi, Mark. What's up?
Well, regarding the, that kills me too. It makes me so upset when it's raining out. And these people have their irrigation systems going, wasting all that water. I think it's only $110 to get a rain sensor. I think it should be made a law. Whoever has irrigation needs to have a rain sensor. The rain sensor gets hooked up to the, like the gutter or the softener fascia of your house. And when it rains, it's made either with a sponge or a cork, and when it swells up, it shuts the irrigation off until it dries out again. It kills me. I'm a landscaper, and I see these people watering their lawns even at 11 o'clock in the afternoon. I thought there was certain times you could water. I think everybody who has a lawn irrigation should be required by law or get fined to have a rain sensor.
All right, Mark, thanks a lot. Thanks for that suggestion.
Thank you.
Hey, we got the word earlier this morning that Aretha Franklin, the queen of soul music, passed away. And so we're going to go out with some Aretha Franklin music right now. It is a huge loss to all of us who love music. And if you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. We'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned for the Midpoint program. We're going to be talking about transportation in Hillsborough County. That's next on Community Radio. This is WMNF Tampa. Aretha on WMNF Tampa.